Welcome to Food Conversations, Season 3. Food Conversations is a program about food in all its aspects, from planting seeds to growing, harvesting, distributing, and eating, with a special emphasis on establishing food sovereignty in the Shuswap. I'm your host, Warren Bell, and you're listening to us on CKVS FM 93.7, The Voice of the Shuswap, community radio for the people, with the people, and by the people. Before we continue, I would like to acknowledge that we are living and working on the ancestral, unceded, and essentially stolen lands of the Shkwepmek people, and that fairly resolving this situation is an ongoing responsibility for us all. Today, I'm delighted to welcome Jennifer Wesley to Food Conversations. Jenny is a young farmer who began her life on a farm, traveled widely both physically and psychologically, and has now returned to farming once again as co-operator at Greencroft Gardens, the very farm where she started out. Welcome, Jenny.
Hello, good morning. I'm really glad to be here. It's super beautiful, sunny spring day here, and I'm hanging out with my cat and just enjoying being able to talk to you.
It's a delight to have you here, Jenny, and your cat is most welcome. And if cats could talk in a language that we could understand clearly, we would invite her to participate in the conversation as well.
Yes.
Jenny, we're going to talk. One of the themes that has run through our conversations up till now is the theme of wanderlust and going from place to place and not just staying geographically or even in terms of your conceptual framework for the world, staying in one place. And I think listeners will recognize that theme as we go on through our conversation. Now, one little piece of gossip that I had, Jenny and I had both misconstrued was that I was present when she was born. As listeners know, I'm a family physician. As it turns out, I should have been present when Jenny was born, but there was something happened. I'm not quite sure it was. Neither of us are really quite sure, and we're not going to ask her mother because she'd know exactly what happened and probably put us in her place, but she would understand. Anyway, we certainly have had a long history together, and it's been a very delightful one. And of course, in our conversations before the show, I learned a lot about how Jenny has really covered an awful lot of territory, both in terms of ideas and concept, but also geographically. Now, one thing that was really clear was that this was not something new. When you were three, talk about the killdeer episode, the great killdeer episode.
So when I was a little girl living here on the farm, I apparently decided to follow a killdeer. And killdeer are a little bird that live in fields, and they like to hop away from their predators and then play dead. And here I am, a little, whatever, three-year-old, following this deer, killdeer, fascinated, I guess, with whatever it was doing, and just continued walking, following it, until I was several properties down, which I don't know exactly, is probably half a kilometer or so away.
In three-year-old steps, it was quite a distance.
Yes, quite a distance, quite an adventure. And I honestly don't remember it very clearly. I was very little, but I do remember hearing the stories about it and my mom saying, like, suddenly, you know, one second I'm there and suddenly I'm gone. And when they found me, of course, they're like shocked and a little bit worried about where I've gone. But I guess, I don't know, I've always been interested in adventures, I suppose.
Well, it was a good start, and it was also a good place to have your first adventure in a rural farming setting. The likelihood of you running across marauding other humans or any other kind of danger would have been pretty limited, which is
just some creeks in the way and animals, I suppose.
Yes, indeed. Well, they probably were all intrigued just as much as the killdeer was. What's going on here? Life in a farm, growing up in a farm. What was that like? Lots of people imagine it, what it's like, but you lived it. What was it like to grow up in a farm?
Honestly, it was quite fun most of the time. Lots of freedom, lots of space to run around, play in the mud, play with animals. I was also homeschooled, so I did spend a lot of time at home, since I didn't actually go to formal schooling except for kindergarten and then grade 11 and 12 in high school. I had two brothers. We did a lot of making forts and riding horses, and yeah, it was good. Obviously, also being so intimately connected with your family's business has its, you know, downsides too. I remember it being quite a struggle, especially at the beginning for my parents financially and starting out also as immigrants in a different place. And it had its good and its bad things for sure. Mostly good though.
In those days, I think you said that even then you were aware of the fact, because of what you heard your parents talking about and how, how challenging it was at the dollar and cents level, not at the, you know, understanding what needed to be done, but at the support level. The support back then compared to support now was much less than for local organic food compared to what's going on now. It's quite dramatically changed, right?
It has. It definitely has. Like, even in my lifetime, which is, you know, not so long, I noticed such a huge difference in people's attitudes and willingness to support local, and just even the awareness of the benefits of eating food that is organic or is local and is not, you know, produced 3,000 miles away and, you know, harvested unripe and taking up so much carbon footprint.
Aren't we starting to realize that food has to be done right? It can't just be mechanized and transported, as you say, 5,000 kilometers. It's crazy. Going from homeschooling to high school for the last couple of years turned out not to be such a challenging transition. You did that pretty readily.
Yeah, I think socially, when you are homeschooled for your whole life, it can be a little bit difficult to feel like you fit in possibly with peers who've been schooled the whole time in a regular school. But overall, it was a positive experience. I enjoyed it very well. I kind of just wanted to get in and out and get my last years done. I think at that time, you couldn't graduate very easily just homeschooling. I think you had to do a certain amount of things in school or correspondence. So for me, I wanted to have a little bit of that experience in the school and figure out if I, you know, if I was missing out on something. But it was a good experience, and I did very well in all my classes except for math, which has always been my weak subject.
Your nemesis.
Yes.
You also commented that you felt a little bit more mature, just a little bit more kind of balanced than you weren't sort of drawn to this whirlwind of social ups and downs and stuff like that. That just didn't seem to be necessary for you.
Yeah, I think in high school it was, I felt a little bit maybe more mature or maybe just not as socially connected to my people my age. I think I did my social fun times more in my 20s when I traveled.
Yes, well, we're definitely going to get into that because there was a lot of traveling and a lot of, you know, investigating the world that went on once you got out of school. When you got out of school, your first step was, you know, pretty much the conventional step for an intelligent young woman. You went to Okanagan College, and perhaps not surprisingly, you started to study political science. But it didn't last, but that's where you went. And what was the transition from going to political science and then saying, we need to look further than this?
Well, I was interested in political science because I've always, I think, had some interest in creating change, in activism, in community building of some kind. But I think for me, the main thing is I felt a little bit, well, it was hard, honestly, financially, being a young person going to school and trying to pay rent and all of the above. But I also felt a bit restless and needing to do my own thing, I think.
And so it wasn't long before you kind of moved on. You started to do some traveling and did some woofing.
Yes.
Okay. Every listener who's on the show needs to know what woofing means, because it's a okay. well-known term in the agricultural world, especially organic agriculture.
Yeah, I think it's a worldwide workers on organic farms, I think is the acronym there. It's a program where people from anywhere in the world can travel anywhere else in the world that has the program and stay on an organic farm for an amount of time, do some volunteer work, learn about farming, about food, about organic lifestyles. And in exchange, they get the cultural experience of wherever they are, room and board, and time with a family that is farming. And so our farm actually hosted woofers for a really long time. And that's probably part of the reason I got very interested in other cultures.
But I started for other parts of the world.
Yes, we had lots of people from Japan, Germany, Korea, France, really a lot of places. It actually got me very interested in Japan as well. but yeah, so when I was 20, I think, 19 or 20, I went woofing on a couple farms close to Victoria and on the Gulf Island, Saturna, which was a very tiny island there. So I spent a couple of months doing that. I guess that would have been like 2005 or six.
Right. And it, I mean, I'm sensing, and I'm sure you are, that there was already this feeling, let's go somewhere, let's get on the road and travel. Well, there's going to be lots of examples of that coming up, I'll tell you. Do you know where the woofing program is coordinated from? I mean, is it a set of, I don't know, protocols or something like that that comes from? It must come from somewhere.
I'm not 100% sure about the details, but I believe it started in England. And I think it started actually with like local farms there where people could do a weekend away. I actually have a biodynamic book from the late 70s, I think, when it started, like a little newsletter pamphlet. And they were talking about weekend workers on organic farms. So I think it started out actually as that.
The first W but was week.
Yeah, but I'm not quite sure how it's working now, where it's based out of. But I do know like they have a website platform. People can go on and become hosts or woofers who want to travel and go to other organic farms.
So from your political science immersion, temporary, what happened after that? You moved, your first traveling experience.
Yeah, so I was woofing for some time on some organic farms as a young person by myself. And after that, I ended up going to Calgary to see some friends of mine and ended up staying in Calgary for a couple of years. yeah, I think part of me, like I love farming and I loved growing up on a farm, but I think because I was so immersed in a very rural lifestyle, I was also very curious about the city life and about seeing things. And I've always had a lot of interest in culture and, you know, going out and food and all of that. So for me, Calgary was kind of the first big city that I encountered and ended up staying for 2 years there.
And having an interesting wake-up call in terms of how people are. So the thing that you did most in Calgary, as I recall, was work in restaurants. You were at the other end of the food system where it's all ready to eat and it gets eaten. And that was kind of that showed you things that were new and different for you. What was that
Absolutely.
Like? What did you learn?
Well, I actually really loved where I worked in Calgary. I had a really great experience with the place. It was called, I don't know if it exists anymore or it was sold to someone else, but it was called Diner Deluxe. And it was run by a husband-wife pair who had several restaurants and were quite committed to high-quality food and actually quite a lot of local, considering that was pushing close to 20 years ago. Mm-hmm. I mean, maybe not quite 16 years ago or so when I was there.
Yeah, certainly before the current era of interest.
And I really enjoyed serving and spending time in the restaurant. It was also a wake-up call of how different people are when they're being served. And I for me, it was very interesting from a like psychological perspective. People show you their best and their worst when they are in restaurants, for sure.
You had a particular incident that really kind of affected you. A well-known public music personality turned up and got pretty rank.
Yeah. Well, this was, we hosted brunches on the weekends and it was very busy and we did not do reservations. So people would wait outside in line and the wait could be anywhere from half an hour to an hour and a half. It really varied. It was a very busy place. It was very popular. And it's Calgary, so it could be pretty cold outside too, if you're waiting. I don't actually recall what the day was like, but I do remember being the host and letting people know in line where they were in their wait and offer them, you know, coffee in line or whatever. And this young woman who I did not know, I don't know if I mentioned this in the pre-interview, I did not know who this was. I've never seen her. I don't know who she is. I never heard her music. But she gets into line with her friend and says she needs to get to the front of the line and needs to get into the restaurant and get seated right away. And I explained to her, no, unfortunately, we have a wait. And I think it was maybe like an hour or 45 minutes. And she lost her temper on me completely, started yelling, telling me, do you know who I am? You can't make me wait in line. I am this and this famous. And then proceeded to say that she would get me fired because she's such a recognizable person. And asked me to call my manager or the owner, which I did. The owner then proceeded to say, no, we will not fire our employee. You have to wait in line like everyone else. And actually, I remember the man that she was with was very embarrassed and very shocked. I think they spoke together for a few minutes and then she ended up actually apologizing. She seemed very annoyed, but she apologized and said, you know, she was having a difficult day. And
the usual excuse.
They did come in and eat and everything. And then I found out from my coworkers who it was. And I said, I still don't know who it was, but everybody was shocked. And
that you had been boldly defending the rules of the restaurant.
Like one of those moments where it was like kind of cool because it was like, you know, how many times do you get yelled at by a famous person? But
This was like David and Goliath, and you didn't even know who Goliath was, just some big
dude. I didn't even know. I know now, though, and I've listened to her music, and she's very talented.
Well, it just shows you can be good at one thing, but not necessarily everything else.
Yeah, or you can have a bad day, but you shouldn't take it out on serving staff.
So that kind of toughened you up psychologically, you know, and in a way, you handled the situation correctly and then found out later that you had stepped into this void and managed to work your way through it. So that was Calgary. This was the life in Calgary where, you know, a farm girl meets a large urban center and sees all the excitement and the interest, etc. But at a certain point, you decided that wandering was back on the schedule, and away you went to Italy, part of a relationship that it didn't work out, but the traveling was really, you started to understand yourself.
That trip was actually not to Italy. That was, my Italian relationship is later in my story, actually. But I did go traveling to Europe and spent I think 4 or 5 months abroad. I'm not 100% sure, but I ended up going to visit my grandmother and some friends in France and spent time in Spain, which later on I go back to Spain multiple times. But this was with a partner that I had in Calgary at the time. And it was a really amazing trip. It also changed the relationship that I was in. And, that did not last, but I was a young woman at the time.
That's not the first time it's really happened.
But it did definitely instill the sense of travel in me. And I think in some ways it also made me realize that for my personality, traveling alone is actually quite important for me.
Okay, that's interesting because obviously that requires a certain amount of poise and a certain amount of self you know, validation. You feel that you can manage this without being swamped. How do you think you got that sense of security in going into new situations and meeting new people? Where did that come from?
I don't even know if it's really a sense of security. I think it's, I don't know. I like the freedom of being out in the world on my own, I think. I like, I don't know, I have a sense of being able to kind of go where I want without being obligated to someone else in that moment. And it's a different experience than when you're in your regular life and you have work obligations and home and all of that. I like the freedom, I guess, of being out on my own.
Sure.
When I'm traveling. I mean, I have a sense of security, but
yeah,
have nervous moments. And
I was thinking more of just the personal security inside yourself to feel confident you could go into a new situation and not feel you had to immediately go and ask somebody else for advice about what to do, but that you can actually go into the situation and wend your way through it quite securely in this sort of social sense and the psychological sense.
Yeah.
And that is another thing that this ability that you have to get into new situations and make them work and find ways to enjoy them as well. So coming back from Europe, I think I've got it. By the way, dear listeners, there's so much traveling and moving around in Jenny's life that we can be forgiven for getting some of the order of events a little bit.
There's a lot.
There is a lot. So, let's say Vancouver.
Yes. Yes. So after I came back from Europe, I moved to Vancouver with a friend of mine and spent time there also working in cafes, restaurants, and doing that to make some money. But I also spent a lot of time doing music, which is one of my big passions. I busked and played in cafes.
You busked during the Olympics.
I busked during the Olympics, yes. A friend of mine and I actually started busking, well, I'm putting this in quotes, illegally on the SkyTrain stations. We tried to get a license for it but could not, so we ended up just playing and running away when the transit police came. I don't even know if transit police are real police.
I don't think they really think that buskers in the wrong place are the greatest threat to social order.
No, it's just bringing joy to people. So, yeah, I did end up then getting a busking license for the Olympics downtown and played a lot of music and wrote a lot of music. I think, again, my passion for activism and for anti-capitalism came through at that time.
That's where it started, you mean? That's where you started to have these feelings? Or did that start in Calgary?
I think they started even younger, but this is, I think, when it really solidified for me. I noticed the horrifying act of kicking all the homeless people out of Vancouver, sticking them in tent cities, which got rained out and flooded.
This is during the Olympics, right?
This is during the Olympics. And Vancouver was like, from one day to another, from having all these people living on the streets, from having people using drugs on the streets, to one day, the next day, everybody's gone. It's totally cleaned up. It's totally like they had never been there. And to me, this was not, I understand it's the Olympics, but it was not appropriate to me at all. And I ended up writing quite a bit of music about this.
Did you?
Yeah.
That's interesting. Yeah, I think there are a lot of people who would share your sentiments that the way to deal with homelessness is not to hide it. The way to deal with it is to deal with it directly. And there are many ways to do it. And we're starting to approach that as we are approaching other kinds of social change. But you were right immersed in it at the street level. So you were seeing it in a very kind of visceral way. It wasn't an intellectual pursuit. You were actually watching it happen around you. Very interesting. So then after a couple of years, or an indeterminate length of time, well, I'm going to say it that way I won't get caught. Then it was back to the farm for a bit.
Yeah. So after a couple colorful years in Vancouver, I I came back to the farm. I had accumulated a bit of debt, probably because I was playing music and not working as much as I should.
debt is like money, but in the negative sense.
Yes, exactly. So I did come back to kind of get back on my feet. And I ended up working on a dairy farm because it paid fairly well.
Right. But a conventional dairy farm.
Conventional dairy farm, yes. A local conventional dairy farm. It paid fairly well, and I did that for a couple years and did pay off all my debt, and that was wonderful, but it was not the most beautiful experience.
You saw the side of growing food that really didn't work for you.
Yes. I think we were milking about 150 cows. Could have been a bit more. I don't quite remember. But just the amount of antibiotics they use, the poor health of many of the cows, the stress of them, taking away babies when they're born. And just like they didn't mistreat the animals, but you could also tell they did not really care about them in the same way as they do on a smaller farm. It was an industry. It was just work for this.
It seemed kind of mechanistic.
Yeah. Mm. I actually ended up being a vegetarian for a few years after milking cows, just because it was so out of it. I did not want to even be part of that. And actually, it's funny, after our last conversation, we were talking about this dairy farm. That night, I had a dream about milking cows, and I was like, no, I do not want to.
Well, I apologize.
One of the reoccurring nightmares in my life, for sure.
Oh, dear. Well, my apologies for dredging that up, although I do interpretation of dreams in my practice, and we could explore that someday. Anyway, we won't do it on the radio today, that's for sure. So that was enough to say time to move on. So you moved on.
Yes.
Where was your next trip? I'm going to get you to tell me so that we get it right.
So my next trip, I had saved up a little bit of money. I was going through a little bit of a rough time personally, which I won't get on the radio, but I decided it was time to get out of the country, to do something different. And I went back to Europe, starting in Germany for my grandmother's 90th birthday, which was amazing. And I was so glad to be there. And then went to Spain because I had heard of a long distance pilgrimage in Spain that I would like to do.
Before we get into the Camino, because that was a very important experience for you, in your family, you said it was like, it felt like going home, even though it was kind of the first time. It was like going home. And especially you mentioned your grandmother and your mother's side.
My father's side.
On your father's side. Yeah. Okay, well, the details can be slippery sometimes. But it was, what did you find there that really sort of really worked for you?
Well, in Germany, I think, like I said, like it didn't feel like totally like home, but I did feel a sense of this is my ancestry and this is my roots. And I, like I said, I was very connected to my grandmother, and hearing her stories and her struggles through war and moving, it, I don't know, to me, that was a very special experience for me.
So Jenny, what would you say about this grandmother of yours that you were meeting? What was it that resonated between the two of you? Obviously, something clicked. What was it that clicked?
I think she just had this, I don't know, she really enjoyed my sense of adventure, and that might be my phone.
Not to worry.
She enjoyed my sense of adventure, and I think in many ways she liked hearing my stories, and she like in some ways lived a little bit through what I did when I told her all of the adventures I'd been on. And it's kind of hard to describe, to be honest.
So you were, what she did was she totally appreciated you as a person.
I think so. Yeah. I think so. And well, and she always made me feel also like I often felt like, oh, I'm not a very conventional person and I have a hard time holding down relationships and all of this. But she always made me feel like that's not even important. It's important that you're traveling and important that you're seeing new things. And it's nice to have that kind of affirmation, I think.
Well, I may not be your grandmother, but I think she's right.
Yeah.
So then you took a sideways move. To Spain.
Yes.
And an important
so I'd heard about the Camino, which is a pilgrimage in Spain. It's been happening for thousand something years. People have been doing this. There are many different routes because people would traditionally just start from their home and walk to Santiago de Compostela in Spain. I decided to do a less walked route because I wanted to be a little bit freer and not have the crowds. Plus, in my previous trip to Spain, I had really loved southern Spain and wanted to start in the south of Spain rather than in the north. So I started in Sevilla and did the 1,000-plus-kilometer walk north to Santiago on my own, started on my own. And it was amazing. It was, to me, probably one of the most important things that I've done in my life. It took about 45 days. It rained the first 25 days straight. The most rain I think they'd had in 40 years in the south of Spain.
Well, that's a life-changing event right there, walking for 25 days.
And it was, to me, it was like walking meditation and a total cultural immersion in Spain because you walk through small towns, not, you know, tourist locations, really. I mean, pilgrims walk through, but because the route is so quiet compared to the other one, it's still very, very authentic.
Really? So you actually got to talk to, interact. I mean, obviously language would, there were some issues with language, but nevertheless, you got to meet some of the people on the way.
Absolutely. A lot of like what we like to call Camino legends. There were a lot of really interesting people, and the people of Spain are so friendly and welcoming and wonderful. Yeah, it was amazing. And that was actually the trip that I met my Italian friend on.
Okay. We've caught up to the Italian connection.
Yes, we met there. And so that's, after Spain, I ended up going to Italy and then spending time in Berlin with my Italian partner at the time.
So you said something about this trip. You said it helped you get back to your center.
Yeah.
What is that center like for you? What's important about it?
I think for the previous years before that, I had struggled a lot with figuring out what I wanted to do. Vancouver had been pretty hard on me, even though it was a lot of fun. And I think I needed just space and time just to be with myself without outside distractions. And I think the Camino is really good for that if you use it properly. I also did not have a mobile phone at the time. I only got my first iPhone, I think, in 2017 or 18. So at this time, I had no phone. I was completely disconnected. And just the sense of waking up every morning, having your coffee, walking for 6 to 10 hours, stopping, showering, whatever, going to sleep and doing the same thing every day, I think it is like a meditation. Mm-hmm. And it did help me just, I don't know how to describe it exactly, but come back to myself, take that time where, you know, it's not about anybody else. It's not about work. It's not about trying to do anything, really.
Feeding the machine.
Not feeding the machine, just being with yourself. And I mean, there are a lot of other people. And like I said, it's a beautiful cultural experience too. So
I'm sure a lot of people listening to the show will understand what you're talking about, this notion that you have to take time to get to know yourself and to know the things that matter to you. One of the things that I've found interesting doing food conversations is exploring with people how they get to where they are now and outlining that it's not a straight line. It isn't something where, you know what you want to do and then you do it. You're not like Mozart, who started writing your first symphony when you're 6 years old. You tried a few things and there's lots of variations and subtleties to what's going on. Then I'm going to take a step here and say Berlin.
Yes. Yeah. So after, after being in Spain and, going to Italy for a little bit, just traveling around, I ended up in Berlin with friends, staying in a really beautiful apartment in Kreuzberg, which is a beautiful part of Berlin. I wanted to do something different. I wanted to spend more time in Europe. And so I stayed there for about a year and sold actually vegetables at a farmer's market for organic farmers who I met. So I did that a few days a week to pay the rent. And other than that, also played music and just enjoyed the culture of Berlin. It was also great because even though I had grown up speaking German, I had lost a bit of my German. But being in Berlin really helped me bring that back. And actually now I'm much more fluent even than I was, you know, as a teenager. So that's... another great benefit from being there.
Now, the work you were doing to get some financial security, working at these three separate farmers markets and organic foods. What was that experience? Because you're on the other side of the Atlantic, you're involved in seeing maybe some of the experiences that your parents had had before they moved to Canada and started an organic farm on this side of the Atlantic. What was it like seeing it over there in this world that they came from?
Well, first of all, I notice everywhere that I go in Europe that there's a lot more support for markets. Mm-hmm. It's much more culturally normal to buy most of your groceries from markets for a lot of people. I mean, that's changed too. I think they have a lot of the industrial food thing too. And, big superstores, but I still think that the support at markets is incredible in Europe.
And that's because it's an older way of getting food, would it not be? I mean, it's more established.
I think these are cultures. It's more established and it's just more in the culture.
Yeah.
Even like I did then later on spend more time in Italy too. And there it's very important for their culture to get local. And it's very important to get, even the cuisines are very regional rather than, you don't buy things from Sicily if you live in the north of Italy. You just don't. You cook with things that are in your area. And to me, that was very fascinating. And I always loved food. So for me, I don't know, this kind of lifestyle really did resonate with me.
Well, it's also a much older way of doing things. The grafting on of long supply chains to the food system arises out of nothing to do with food. It arises out of a certain kind of corporate kind of structure.
Absolutely.
And the so-called, I'll use the word neoliberal capitalism here on the show. It's not the first time. This idea that somehow, as long as you get the food, that's all that matters.
I think here there is more of a model that big business has it easier and small businesses get the brunt of the regulations and stuff, because that's the other thing I noticed in Europe is the amount of things they can sell at markets that here it would be like a big red flag if you sell, at least in the past, if you sold salami without being refrigerated or, that there isn't quite that fear of food in some ways too in Europe.
Yes, I remember hearing a story of a pie maker at a farmer's market in Prince George who'd been selling pies for 25 years without any problems. And then a new regulation was brought in that said you have to have it baked in a kitchen that was perfectly sanitized in the, full measure. And after 25 years, she just had to stop selling her pies. And nobody ever complained. In fact, there'd be a big lineup, just like your restaurant in Calgary.
Exactly. So what happened after 25 years of perfectly good pies?
Suddenly she became persona non grata. And on that, talking about Europe and various countries, France is one country that specifically, against considerable criticism, kept on supporting its small farmer base. which at the time, you know, 30 years ago, was considered in the face of expanding supply routes for food and the growing of food in countries where labor was cheap and shipping it to countries where markets were more funded. France was criticized for that, but it was a deliberate policy, and now it's looking like being a little prescient, like seeing into the future how things should be done. So interesting. You were right in the middle of all this, and cities have always fascinated you. I mean, not necessarily to be there all the time, but just to explore the riches that cities actually are repositories for.
Yes. I've always had a fascination with cities, and I think part of that is I like seeing different people. I like the cultural aspect. I like a little bit also the convenience of you can go out and do what you want, and you know, you don't have to drive anywhere. So for me, that's always been interesting. I've lived in a few cities, actually. So
you've tasted them, but not necessarily going to make them your full diet.
No, not the full diet.
So I'm going to put out Toronto Forest School.
So I was in Europe, came back to Canada, and then I went in 2015 to Toronto, and spent a little bit of time there, where I also worked in restaurants, but I also did a little side project for not a very long time, but with a friend of mine who said, you would be perfect for this forest school that we're doing. And it was a school, a nature-based school, where kids would come 2 days a week. They were between 3 and 6 years old. And we went into this giant park in Toronto, and we would explore. We would learn survival skills. We would identify plants, identify animal footprints or other, you know, signs, learn about seasons. It was just a way of connecting kids back to Earth, back to nature, and they would learn, you know, other skills in the process.
So what was it like watching these kids explore things that, to some extent, you were a little more familiar with from your own experiences growing up at a farm that was embedded in the wild countryside? What was it like watching these kids and teaching them?
I think, to be honest, kids that age, they're so open to the experiences. It's more the older people, I think, that are more stuck in their ways. So for them, it almost like becomes natural for them to be out in the wild, I think, actually, you know, with your guidance, and they know they're safe. I think for them, they right away adapt to enjoying it and learning very quickly.
And they, having you there, they didn't have to have their parents chase down the road to find where they'd gone chasing that
killer. Yeah, exactly. So there was always like, I think, 3 or 4 adults, and we had a group of about 10 or 12 kids.
Absolutely. This was controlled exposure to Mother Nature.
Yes, exactly.
So from the city, let's go back to the trail. The Camino, yeah. Camino 2. Let's call it Camino 2.
Camino 2.0.
Yes. The hot version versus the wet version.
Exactly. So in 2017, this is actually when my Italian relationship dissolved. I decided that I would probably be coming back to Grindrod, but that first I wanted to go back to the Camino. So I went in, it was end of May or middle of May when I went in 2017. The first time I went was middle of March and had been super rainy. When I went back now in middle of May, I did the same route because I had loved it and wanted to experience it again, maybe in different weather. It took me less time. I walked faster and farther, I guess. And it was very, very hot. So this time, instead of being rainy, I had most days temperatures of 40 upwards in the afternoon. So I had to start walking at 5:30 in the morning and quit by about noon or 1 if I could.
Do the Spanish siesta routine.
Do the Spanish siesta routine, yep. So I did it again on my own, met interesting people, and It was really great.
How would you describe the difference between the two experiences, the first and the second, Camino 1 and Camino 2?
Other than the obvious weather.
Yes, we'll accept that.
I think I, at this point, was realizing that even though I really loved traveling, that it was time maybe for me to find a little bit of a home base. Mm-hmm. I had already been thinking about coming back to Grönland, but I think that was becoming more clear that I needed more security for myself in the sense of just a place to be that I'm not running away from. And yeah.
And you came back to the farm and you went back to school.
Yeah. So it was actually during my Toronto time that I had started taking some classes in psychology through Thompson Rivers University online program, which I continued to do. And I'm now basically a year short of having a degree, but have not finished. But I started studying psychology just because I am interested in human nature. And I'm quite fascinated with how the mind works, with just learning more about people in general.
And you mentioned one thing. You mentioned transgenerational problems, because that is a big feature in now that we're acknowledging and talking mm-hmm. about Indigenous experiences at the hands of the settler community, our ancestors from Europe. It's clear that what happens to you shapes who you are in dramatic mm-hmm. ways.
Yeah, it is something I'm really fascinated in, how things get passed on through generations, whether that is trauma or addiction or, you know, all these things. They don't just stay with you, they continue. And in my own family, there have been some issues with some mental health and sure. addiction as well. And I'm curious about how that has affected me and other people in my family. So from that personal perspective, it's been something I'm interested in. But yeah, also, like you said, with the Indigenous people and with all kinds of experiences out there, it doesn't just stay with the one generation. It continues. And that has always fascinated me.
The other side of this, of course, is the wellness side. In other words, mm-hmm. it's not just problems and deficits yeah. and harm. There's also wellness. There's also the kind of element of spiritual development as well. That also mm-hmm. become part of what you were interested in. And that's led to some really important things you're doing now. But how did that come in when you were studying? Did you hear about that, or did that come outside your actual coursework?
The more spiritual side?
Yes, and wellness. The idea that
I think it came from my whole lifetime, not necessarily from my courses, although probably was supported by those as well. I've always been quite fascinated with spirituality and with sort of holistic health, not doing things totally from an allopathic perspective, but looking at things as a whole. But I did become very interested in yoga and energy work and herbalism, especially in the last, like, I don't know,
two or
six, 7 years.
Well, tell us about the evolutionary school of herbalism.
Yeah, so this is a school in the States, in Portland. They offer quite a few programs in holistic herbalism. I started there and did a clinical herbalism program with them, which took me about a year and a half, and learned a lot. To me, I also learned a lot on my own. I think as a lifelong homeschooler, I thrive in doing my own thing. But
yes. Learning is not contained in a building.
No, but it was nice to have that container and sure. the resources that they provided. And I'm very grateful. I've actually thought of maybe continuing and doing a few other courses with them or with someone else, because I don't think you can, you know, you can never learn everything in one go.
Yes, it's you never learn it. That could be the hallmark for almost every human being on the planet. The idea that we've learned it all and we're finished. You also you had a friend from Denmark who was telling you about some of the about the extent of social support services in that country, and mm-hmm. and that had a bit of an impact on you. Talk about that a little bit. What did you learn from her description?
Yeah. Well, I was feeling a little disillusioned with the cost of schooling in Canada. It's not easy. I mean, it's not the worst in the world, but it's not easy to pay for school and pay for everything else. And when I spoke with my friend who lives in Denmark, she's Canadian, but lives in Denmark, she was speaking of the amazing social program that their government provides people. Their taxes are higher. But from my understanding, I've been there and visited, and from talking with her, their lifestyle is amazing. Everybody is quite provided for. She actually went back to school before having her child and was not only having free schooling, but it was also paid during her schooling so that she could pay for rent and food and basic needs while studying. And to me, this idea is very important, because I think as we can see, the model that we have doesn't quite work, I don't think. I think we are better in Canada than maybe the States or other places, but I still think that our social programs are improving but could improve more.
They could definitely improve more. You weren't finished traveling because there was Mexico. Summer of 2018. What was that about?
Yeah. So I went to Mexico because I had, by the way, I don't have money. I'm a 30 something person who's just spent their money on traveling instead of settling down, I guess.
Well, there's other kinds of riches than just money. And I think you've gained a very large store of other riches. You were in Mexico in 2018.
Yeah. I spent I spent about a month there before our farming season started in 2018. I just wanted to see something different. I'd never been to Mexico before. and yeah, I was at the beach for a little while and then went to some little mountain towns in the state of Jalisco and just explored. My Spanish was a little bit better at this point after being in Spain.
Indeed.
A few times.
But that was nothing like the trip to India in 2019, where you went and explored some spiritual kind of ends of things. What happened there?
Yes, in 2019, which is my last traveling before this whole pandemic issue, I went to India because I was very interested in yoga, but I wanted to study from where it came from. And I wanted to get a perspective on the actual culture and the people in that place. I have a little bit of a conflicted feeling about a lot of modalities. I don't want to appropriate anything. And I also just want to be respectful of where things come from. And so for me, that was the main reason that I wanted to go there. Plus, of course, it was really amazing to just see
experience
something different.
Indian culture, indeed, which is, yeah, has some significant differences from ours. In the summer of 2019, you were back and started to really engage more in the work of Greencroft Gardens.
Mm-hmm.
That's, you're re-immersing yourself into the world that you grew up with. So we're going to talk next week. We're going to talk at length about Greencroft Gardens and what you're doing there.
Mm-hmm.
But what was it like coming back after, you know, pretty much covering large parts of the globe? Now you're back on that same patch of land on which you chased a killdeer and generally sort of experienced a lot of compelling and enjoyable things in your life. What's that like?
Well, it's been overall quite an exciting experience for me, because I am also interested in herbalism. I'm feeling very grateful to be able to explore that and grow things for my own side of things. But I think for me, the most important part of being back is just being with my family, too. I know my parents are happy to have somebody there who... you know, who's taking on sort of a continuation of the farm. And I'm very interested in the community side of things, which is why now I've been doing the Salmonar Market for a couple of years and taking that on as my sort of side of the business. I find the Salmonar community very supportive, and just I'm really grateful to be there with them.
So with just about 3 minutes more to go, I'm just going to throw some names of people out to you, and you can give me a capsule of what their impact has been on you. So Michael Pollan?
Yeah, I've been reading a few of his books over the years. The Omnivore's Dilemma was my first one, I think, as many people had. I recently read his book, and now it's totally slipping my mind. I think it's called How to Change Your Mind, which is a book that he wrote about recent studies in psychedelics, which is something I'm curious about too, especially since, you know, it is psychology in its own way.
And it's also coming into medical work.
Yeah.
Here's another name, Sarah Faith Gottsteiner, God's yes. servant.
She is a teacher of mine. She teaches, she's a witch, which I can identify with myself. She teaches a lot about moon phases and about just general aligning your life with seasons and with,
So one more.
Yeah, very fascinating person.
Well, these are influences, and they're all playing their role. And finally, Renee Sills.
Yeah, so Renee is an embodied astrologer. So she studies astrology, but she also is very interested in somatics and body work. And for me, it's very interesting because I also have learned a little bit about astrological herbalism and that impact on your body. Something I'm interested in, so her work's always fascinated me, and she's just a very eloquent and powerful public speaker, which I also admire because I don't always feel like I am.
Well, I think the listeners to this show will probably disagree with you.
All right.
Find you very animated. We're going to come to an end now, but I want to thank you very much, Jenny, for being on the show
today.
Yeah,
thank you so much for having me.